From the studios of WRPI in Troy, New York, this is Little Brother, the show where we talk about high technology, low intelligence, what happens when you mix the two, and where, like any responsible little brother, we tell on Big Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter, and I'll be your host for the next hour as we explore this world of the high tech. This is episode number 11 of Little Brother, dated June 22nd, 2001. Stay tuned. Little Brother is right around the corner. Get started. So just how stealthy is the $3.6 billion stealth bomber? Radar would need to look straight up at the bomber's flat bottom surface. Tracking would therefore require a vast array of antennas, but according to a story early this week in the London Daily Telegraph, such arrays already exist. Roque Manor Research in Britain claims that stealth aircraft can be tracked by their effect on ordinary mobile telephone traffic. News media in the U.S. did not discover the story until June 14th. The Pentagon is taking it seriously, and other nations, including China, are now developing such systems. By the way, I forgot to mention at the start of the show that if you want to throw your opinion in, please feel free to call. The number here at the WRPI studios is area code 518-276-6248. That number again, 518-276-6248. And I will give that out a few more times throughout the course of the show. Seattle Times is reporting that a data entry error has killed five patients in Panama. Data entered incorrectly in a computer program used in radiation therapy for cancer patients has caused at least five deaths. For 28 cancer patients, healthy tissue was inadvertently exposed to high levels of radiation, said David Kidd, spokesman for the International Atomic Energy Agency. So far, five deaths have been linked to the radiation exposure, while two other deaths are from ambiguous causes. One patient died from cancer. Agency experts expect that two-thirds of the surviving patients will develop serious complications. Radiologists using the program assume that the computer software had a fail-safe mechanism that would prevent healthy tissue from being exposed to radiation. But the five radiology experts from the International Atomic Energy Agency found that healthcare workers incorrectly entered the data, administering dangerous levels of radiation to healthy tissue. Had the instruction manual been followed to the letter, this wouldn't have happened, but this wasn't once done. And of course, the obvious risk here is that if you have to follow the instructions to the letter to get the exact result, and there is no room for human error, you're in a dangerous situation. Your opinion? 518-276-6248. Let's hear it. WashingtonPost.com, an association with a local real estate agency, has put up a database of home sale prices and property tax appraisal values. They've merged together six tax records and real estate database systems from the several counties in the Washington, D.C. metropolitan area. And some of the records are as detailed as multiple listing services that you'd find while looking for a home to buy. This database will prove useful for people trying to compare the price of a property that they're considering with the values of the neighboring properties. However, because you can search by owner as well as by zip code or address, it has some nasty privacy implications. For instance, one can find the listing for your former manager's home knowing only his last name and the county in which he lives. Worse, you can find his street address, something not available through conventional sources. Trolling through the deed listings is like, well, and the like is an old risk. Consolidating it and putting it in a too-easy-to-use web interface is a comparatively new risk. Inquiries to WashingtonPost.com about privacy implications of this were referred to the real estate editor, who has not responded after more than a week. It's enough to make me even more glad that I rent instead of owning my home. A new line of business software introduced by Alta Vista will let workers scour corporate networks, email accounts, and personal computers by stitching together value and sometimes embarrassing information scattered on far-flung office computer systems. By making it easy to retrieve information from a hodgepodge of computer servers, email accounts, and PC hard drives, the search software effectively creates a peer-to-peer network similar to the one popularized by the online music sharing website Napster, which is battling to stay afloat after running afoul of copyright laws. The Alta Vista software is based on the premise that businesses operating in an information-driven era will be better off if employees can sift through a community storehouse of data gathered from corporate intranets, workers' email boxes, and PC hard drives. The premise only holds if the network is trustable. I'm sure most of us treat web pages with an appropriate degree of mistrust. As for Napster, how many MP3s downloaded were actually of good quality? I wonder how many pointy-haired bosses would fall for a document posted on a server with no links to it but submitted to the master index. Not to mention the privacy risks. Nick Brown writes that he had an illuminating experience while waiting in line to pay at a sports shop. The clerk and cashier at the register next to where he was waiting finished up her shift and was replaced by a colleague, so he got to see how the changeover worked. For once, although it involves Microsoft products, it's not really a Microsoft bashing story, but just another tale of complacency and idiocy from corporate information technologies. He had already noticed that the small and very cute LCD display, a 10-inch thin film, perhaps. But the first indication that he had of the fun to come was when the first cashier stood up and a Windows NT logon prompt appeared as her logoff completed. The second cashier then sat down and typed his or her username, rather, and her password, which appeared to consist of two letters. He says he was then surprised to see four DOS windows pop open and display various messages as a whole series of programs started up. Most notable amongst these was a virus checker. It seemed to be taking some time to complete, and although NT had not been set up to prevent the desktop loading until the check was complete, the user decided to clear it from the screen anyway. Instead of minimizing it, she killed it and the other three DOS windows with the X button. Some preliminary conclusions. The register is using basic Windows NT procedures with a trivial password as some form of security. They've installed some El Cheapo antivirus software, which doesn't run in the background. The users are killing the antivirus software, either because it slows down their work or because they haven't had the minimum training required to know how to minimize a window. Of course, the window could have been started minimized anyway. And since the PC has no diskette drive or internet connection, it's not even clear exactly what virus threat is being protected against or when the AV software was last updated. Overall summary, this company's IT department is staffed by people who have no understanding of the issues, just a boss who demands buzzword-based results. I would hazard a guess that they are patting themselves on the back because their antivirus software has successfully kept out, as in not detected, any viruses. I suppose it's superfluous to mention that the large monitor above the entrance to the store, which is meant to display the store's webpage, has on the last three occasions that he's visited displayed a blue screen of death from Windows 95. A new computer virus called VBS.NOPED.A now circulating invades computer memories in a hunt for picture files with pornographic-sounding names and reports them to the police. The virus arrives from an unknown source as an email attachment with a subject line, "Forward, help us all to end illegal child porn now." If it finds suspected pornography, it sends a message to the police saying, "This is Antipedo 2001. I have found a PC with known child pornography files on the hard drive. I have included a listing below and included a sample for your convenience." An executive of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children has repudiated the rogue effort and says his group does not support unlawful means even to achieve meritorious ends. This was reported from the New York Times. Uwe Ose writes that he had recently gone to a software security mailing list about a vulnerability in some software package and got an email stating someone saw an article in SecurityFocus.com's vulnerability database claiming he posted it to another security mailing list. He had a look and found a number of errors in the database entry. The vulnerability in question is a local one, not a remotely exploitable bug. The bug database got it exactly the other way around. The database entry states that the bug exists in version 1.0, but not in 1.0.1 to 1.0.3. This is wrong. The bug still exists in version 1.1.0. Don't know about older versions. There are other minor incorrect bits of information. The risk is obvious. And if you'd like to take a risk, we'd love to hear from you. The number here is area code 518-276-6248. Leonard Erickson writes, I just found a website offering a part I needed for an obsolete computer I'm working on. I clicked the checkout icon and was presented with a field to enter a customer name and account number and a button to click if I wanted to purchase without establishing an account. I clicked the button and was presented with a screen to enter shipping address and billing address, complete with phone number, email address, the works, which would have been perfectly fine except that the data for the last customer was still there. The risks are obvious. I assume a script error of some sort failed to clear a temporary file or buffer. This wasn't the only error. The billing address half of the page was heading billing address if different from shipping address. But when I tried to clear out the fields, upon clicking continue, it made me go back and fill them out anyway. And then the final insult. The item was on sale, and the price displayed was the regular price. I've notified the site owner, and they've said that they will fix it. The real irony is that they have a prominent notice about their privacy policy. Last week, we noted some potential problems with McDonald's proposal to use Freedom Pay and Fast Track payment systems. This item comes from Rob Slade. He says, I was mentally ticking off all the reasons I couldn't see much advantage to using this type of procedure in a fast food restaurant. I don't use drive-through venues all that much, so I'm not used to paying for my food with my keys. And consider the drive-through. At the second window, are you really going to turn off the engine, take out your keys, swipe the wand, put the keys back in the ignition, and stall out repeatedly while the guy in the monster truck behind you leans on his horn? I've already got enough keys that my case is awkward. Anything smaller than a pocket knife is going to be hard to find in my change pocket. The possibility of losing a tiny item that is keyed to my credit card and possibly not finding out until the next statement comes is kind of disturbing. And yes, the assertion that participants can load their Freedom Pay account via the internet or over the phone would seem to allow the possibility of being defrauded even if you don't participate in the trial. But as I was considering the actual transaction in the store, I started to wonder about the stated reasons for using the system. It isn't going to make the purchase any faster for the customer. Consider the usual situation at the moment. You order. The cashier starts to put together your meal. But if you want anything more than a standard dark carbonated beverage, there generally comes a point at which the hunting and gathering process is stymied. There aren't enough fries, or you've ordered a salad wrap, you health food freak, you. Or you don't want that much mayonnaise, I'm sorry, chicken sauce, and so something needs to be made before your order can complete. At this point, the cashier returns to the till, leaving your shake under the hot lamp and your nuggets beside the soft serve freezer, takes your money, and gives you your change. Then you wait some more, and finally, get your food units. So, does the possession of a wand save you, the customer, any time? Generally speaking, the answer will be no. Does the fast food chain gain many sales because you have McDonald's wand and not one for Burger King? The respective chains will have their own religious marketing beliefs in that regard, but again, the answer is much more likely to be no. The three factors in the success of a restaurant have always been in order of priority, location, location, and, of course, location. McDonald's and its ilk aren't keen on participating in food court situations, where you have a choice and where the possession of a wand might have tipped the scales in their favor. So, why are they keen on the idea? The most likely reason would seem to involve that cashier. Even at minimum wage, the cost of processing an order and dealing with cash has to run about 30 to 70 cents per order. 30 to 70 cents per order in wages plus additional costs. Once the capital costs of a WAN system are covered, the cost of the billing part of the order can be reduced to an almost arbitrarily low figure. And was it not McDonald's who recently did a trial with a terminal where patrons could compose their orders and then pick them up at the counter? With both systems in place, the joint moves one step closer to becoming a giant vending machine, albeit with much less choice than an automat, where you push buttons, wave your wand, and wait for the bag to thump into the slot. And wait, eliminate those pesky employees, and you eliminate cost. Next item here comes from the Daily Telegraph of London. First, there was the computer virus. Now scientists have found a fungus that eats compact discs. Victor Cardenas of Spain's leading scientific research body stumbled across the microscopic creature 2 years ago while visiting Belize. Friends complained that in the hot and sticky Central American climate, a CD had stopped working and had developed an odd discoloration that left parts of it virtually transparent. Dr. Cardenas and colleagues at the Superior Council for Scientific Research in Madrid discovered a fungus was steadily eating through the supposedly indestructible disc. The fungus had burrowed into the CD from the outer edge, then devoured the thin aluminum layer and some of the data-storing polycarbonate resin. Dr. Cardenas said it completely destroys the aluminum, it leaves nothing behind. Biologists at the council had never seen this fungus, but concluded that it belonged to a common genus called Geotrichium. Philips, the Dutch electronics company that invented the compact disc, said it believed that the Belize case was probably a freak incident caused by extreme weather conditions. Okay. I have one here that I think is very important and will probably be very near and dear to the hearts of many of the more radical WRPI listeners. This is from a press release from the Independent Media Center. On June 13th, in a case involving internet press freedom, the U.S. government withdrew a previously issued court order directing the Independent Media Center to settle handover the Independent Media Center in Seattle to hand over computer server logs. The April 21st order instructed the IMC, a not-for-profit internet-based news organization, to hand over logs and other records pertaining to the IMC's coverage of anti-globalization protests in Quebec City. The government's retreat represents a victory for the IMC, where volunteers and national legal teams had been preparing to challenge the order in court. The IMC is undecided about further legal action. IMC counsel Nancy Chang of the Center for Constitutional Rights comments that although the court order has been withdrawn, the IMC's concerns over the government's ability to use internet technology for surveillance of political activists continue to linger. At the time of the order's issuance, FBI and Secret Service agents claimed that they needed the server logs to assist in an investigation related to sensitive documents which had been stolen from the Canadian police, then posted on the IMC website by an anonymous journalist. The agents also falsely claimed that posted documents contained details of George Bush's travel itinerary. Bush was at the time attending the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City. IMC volunteers learned several weeks ago that police in Quebec identified and arrested three suspects in the stolen documents case without any information provided by the IMC. Still, the U.S. government neither amended nor withdrew its order against the IMC until the 13th of June, instead allowing the order to continue absorbing the volunteer organization's personnel and legal resources. Timing of the original order issued while mass protests were still underway in Quebec City suggests that the government intended to produce a chilling effect amongst IMC journalists covering those events, a suggestion that was strengthened by the government's failure to withdraw its order even weeks after the Canadian arrests. The IMC did not comply with the order, which would have involved handing over the individual Internet protocol addresses of over 1.25 million journalists, readers, and technical volunteers, including yours truly, I might add, who accessed the IMC website on April 20th and 21st a much broader sweep than the stated focus of the government's investigation. According to IMC Counsel Li Tian of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, this kind of fishing expedition is another in a long line of overboard and onerous attempts to chill political speech and activism. Back in 1956, Alabama tried to force the NAACP to give up its membership lists, but Supreme Court stopped them. This order to the IMC, even without the gag, is a threat to free speech, free association, and privacy. The case drew immediate interest from some of the nation's top First Amendment advocacy organizations. With help from the Electronic Frontier Foundation, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, the Center for Constitutional Rights, and others, the IMC prepared to challenge the invasive order in court. However, on the eve of the IMC's planned court filing, the government suddenly withdrew the order. IMC volunteers speculate that the government lawyers realized the likelihood that the order would be struck down on constitutional grounds and decided to retreat rather than to face a court defeat. Tian adds, "The government owes the IMC, its many users, and the general public an explanation. Maybe that will prevent this sort of thing from happening again. With the court order withdrawn, the IMC is denied the immediate opportunity to have the courts rule on several serious constitutional rights, including, under U.S. law, freedom of speech guaranteeing the right to speak anonymously. This principle has been established repeatedly in the federal courts and has been found recently to apply to Internet speech as well. On April 19th, District Judge Thomas Zille ruled in Seattle that Internet firm TheMart.com should not compel an Internet chat room host to identify anonymous users who had criticized the firm online. Freedom of association, particularly anonymous association, is afforded very strong protection under the law. Anonymity in public discourse has been a central theme in the history of American democracy. Even the Federalist Papers were published under fictitious names. On the Internet, anonymity is particularly important because it enables individuals to disguise their race, gender, class, or other indicators which might lead to their marginalization in public space. Journalists hold a qualified privilege from compelled disclosure of sources and other work product. The Constitution requires this protection because a court-compelled disclosure of news-gathering materials poses a serious threat to the vitality of the news-gathering process and a free press. The government's order falsely describes the AIMC as an Internet service provider rather than as a news organization. Independent journalists posting stories or photographs to IMC websites are entitled to the same protections as any other member of the news media. The IMC was launched in fall of 1999 to provide immediate, authentic grassroots coverage of protests against the WTO. Just a year and a half later, the IMC network has reached around the world with dozens of sites scattered across six continents. Each IMC news coverage centers upon its open publishing newswire, an innovative and democratizing system allowing anyone with access to an Internet connection to become a journalist. Open publishing enables the IMC to present a local and national issues from diverse perspectives, independent of many filters and biases affecting mainstream media coverage. The IMC's mission statement reads, "The Independent Media Center is a grassroots organization committed to using media production and distribution as tools promoting social and economic justice. It is our goal to further the self-determination of people underrepresented in media production and content, and to illuminate and analyze local and global issues that impact ecosystems, communities, and individuals. We seek to generate alternatives to the biases inherent in the corporate media controlled by profit, and to identify and create positive models for a sustainable and equitable society." The program you are listening to is Little Brother. My name is Chuck Ritter. The topic is technology. If you have an opinion, please feel free to express it. Give us a call. 518-276-6248 is the number here at WRPI Studios. I'm going to take about a 5-minute break here. This is Devo on WRPI Troy. to 91.5 FM WRPI in Troy. My name is Chuck Ritter. The show is Little Brother, and the topic is technology. Although, I'm going to deviate slightly for a moment here, because I have an article here that I think is kind of interesting. This is, let me see if I can find the author of this article. Yes, this is an article by Chris Johnson that was published on the www.airwindows.com website. And it's about evergreen albums. That is, the ones that have, in music, the record albums that have done particularly well. But it's a kind of a damning report about the state of the recording industry today. And since I've spoken about that topic before, I thought I would pick it up and talk about it a bit tonight. First of all, before I begin this one, I'm going to tell you it's presented somewhat from a technical point of view. Those of you out there who are technically inclined will understand what I'm talking about. Those who are not, I ask you to just kind of wait it out because the conclusions are still valid. What he did in this particular case is he wrote the summary after using Perl to examine a list of commercially important albums, commercially important artist careers, etc., etc. And along with it, published some files that were produced along the way, which you can download if you're interested. The URL is www.airwindows.com/analysis/evergreens.html. The evergreens is spelled with the leading E capital. Anyway, he starts off with a list of the top 10 commercially important albums. Those would be Eagles' Greatest Hits, Led Zeppelin 4, The Beatles' White Album, Pink Floyd' The Wall, Michael Jackson's Thriller, Fleetwood Mac' Rumors, The Beatles' 1967 to 1970, Pink Floyd's Dark Side of the Moon, Elton John's Greatest Hits, and Boston's self-titled album. The top 10 commercially important artist careers are The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, Hollywood movie soundtracks, Elvis Presley, collection and promo albums, The Eagles, Pink Floyd, Billy Joel, Elton John, and Barbara Streisand. He writes, "This is a study of long-term album sales trends using data taken from the Recording Industry Association of America's website. The data is downloadable as text files for further analysis. My primary interest in doing this study was to work out which albums and artists have been able to drive long-term sales even after the record industry hype had moved on to other newer records, and whether there were any surprises in the data. There were. The numbers you will see are the product of two different numbers relating to each record, number of platinums or millions sold, and the number of years an album has been on the market. I feel an adjustment was necessary for several reasons. First, the whole purpose of the study is to identify long-term sellers. There's no such thing as a long-term seller over 1 year or 8 months, so I'm thinking more in terms of people still buying the album 10, 20, 30 years later. As such, weighting older albums is obligatory. Second, the total sales of RIAA tracked albums has exploded, particularly in recent years. To some extent, this is affected by a concentration of sales on relatively few albums, which is an observation I'll explore, but is also evidence of a market that's been expanding to date, and if I was just to count millions, newer albums would be unnaturally weighted, apparently very important, but with very little justification for this. Britney Spears is not, for example, more historically important than the Beatles. She fits into a long-established category dating back to the Monkees, and even earlier than that. There is considerable evidence to suggest that when Britney stops being pushed on the market by her record company, sales will fall off of a cliff in contrast to some other artists who are more capable of establishing a sustained career. So that's the purpose of this study, to examine what's happening with industry practices, who's being sold, and what the artists with sustained careers have in common. The base file is Evergreen Albums Alphabetical. Also available in a total, also available is the total sorted list as the most commercially important albums ever, and the list broken down in artist careers by adding all the albums for each artist together. The top 10 of each are what you see leading off on the page. That was what I read off a minute ago. The list is a complete RIAA database as sorted by artist. If you're wanting to look up a particular artist, this would be the quickest way to go about it. The file introduces the record format, a score number, which is a zero filled and represents the number of certified platinums times the number of years since the album's release, then the artist name alphabetized on last name and the album name. For instance, Bruce Springsteen's platinum albums follow the format, 255, Bruce Springsteen, Born in the USA. Straightforward enough. Already there are many suggestive points to the reckoning. As almost anyone on the planet knows, Born in the USA was Bruce Springsteen's biggest album. But how about in the light of historical perspective? In that light, Bruce's first two albums were very important, and Born to Run broke him to a larger audience, as noted on the following observation. Darkness on the Edge of Town scored a 69, Greetings from Ashbury Park, New Jersey scored a 56, The River a 63, and The Wild, the Innocent, and E Street Shuffle a 56. Take out Born in the USA and Born to Run, both instances in which the record company geared up to sell ludicrous number of records, and Bruce Springsteen's albums tend to approximate to roughly the same number. This also holds true for some other acts, such as Dan Fogelberg, who also shows the characteristic, a capacity for consistently selling double platinum over the duration. It's useful to know. In some cases, an artist will maintain a steady average and then exceed from time to time. For example, Pat Benatar, whose Crimes of Passion album scores 84, while her other albums are scoring 19 for Get Nervous, 22 for Heat of the Night, 18 for Live from Earth. 40 went up again with Precious Time. Precious Time went up again with 40, and Tropico scored a 17. Just to reiterate, these numbers are the number of millions sold times the number of years that the album has been on the market. Pat Benatar has four platinum albums in the 17 to 22 range, primarily illustrating a time period during which she routinely went single platinum, the equivalent of a multi-platinum today. Not all acts follow this pattern, as obvious as it seems. Consider Boston. Their self-titled album scores a 400, Don't Look Back a 161, Greatest Hits, 4, Third Stage, 60, and Walk On, 7. Boston, of course, was the studio production of the perfectionist Tom Scholz, and though the first album was enormously influential, there were such long delays between albums that Boston didn't sustain the career that they might have, even though one album was more commercially important than many artists' entire careers. In some cases, the artist is able to keep a momentum going after a monster debut album, such as Guns N' Roses, a determined band with a distinctive sound and featuring opinionated and colorful musicians. I suppose that's a politically correct way of putting it. Guns N' Roses' Appetite for Destruction scores a 210, GNR Lies a 65, The Spaghetti Incident 8, and Use Your Illusion 1 and 2 score 70 apiece. Contrast this with what happens when a competent band that gets swept up in a storm of record label media hype happens, such as Hootie and the Blowfish. They're nowhere as definitive or offensive. Nowhere as offensive or controversial as GNR, but unfortunately, they don't show the capacity to drive sustained sales like they had, GNR had. Their first album, Cracked Rear View, got a 112 on this scale. Fairweather Johnson a 15, and Musical Chairs a 3. Yet in some ways, this isn't Hootie's fault, because there's evidence to suggest that the nature of record label hype had changed by the time Hootie came around. GNR represent the very last wave of career bands, and in the pattern of promotion given, Hootie was not the same. A good example is In Warrant, which illustrates some of the things that the numbers do not show. Cherry Pie scored a 22, Dirty Rotten Filthy Stinking Rich a 24. Seems normal enough, but when you look at the certification dates, Warrant went double platinum within a year, and then it's been 10 years since then without an additional platinum. This is not the same pattern as the career bands of earlier days, not the same pattern as GNR. It's evidence of a shift in record promotion between the mid-80s and the mid-90s towards the stuffing the channel full of an album, selling as many copies as possible, and then completely letting the artist drop. There are very few acts post-1990 that can boast platinum certifications after more than a year after release. The pattern is hit and run, and the change is striking. And given the numbers involved in the music business, damning. In an industry where the top acts will sell 10, 15, 18 platinums, it is revealing when an act goes multi-platinum in months and then stops selling when the label stops stuffing the channel full of the album. There's substantial risk to this strategy, and the reasons for it can only be guessed at. Musicians of previous decades have commented on the music industry's abandonment of artist development with some rancor, but to understand the reasons, you have to look beyond just the artist's capacity for long-term sales and consider the bargaining position of an act with a track record for multi-platinum sales. The act has a lot of bargaining power. They probably have their own lawyers and business team. This is obligatory for a band even wishing to operate on those levels. And label-appointed lawyers will not do. In every way, such a band is capable of extracting the maximum royalty, still rather small compared to what the public thinks artists get, from the record label. In contrast to that, if the record company picks up a naive unknown and pumps the sales channel full of their debut album, they can hang on to a lot more of the money once you subtract the enormous costs of independent promotion and all of the apparatus of modern payola, which the record companies are stuck paying if they want to sell any records at all. The promoters will just as happily push Hanson as Bob Dylan, Spice Girls as Aretha Franklin. They are completely agnostic on the quality front. They are the mechanism through which it's more profitable for the labels to churn through the new and manufactured artists, such as Spice Girls, Britney Spears, and NSYNC Dixie Chicks. It applies to all genres than it is to build extended careers and trade off the capacity for an artist to develop a reputation that drives continued sales. In effect, the record labels cannot afford to build artists' careers anymore. They can only afford to milk the current promotional mechanism. The risk of this strategy is this. It assumes that the promotional mechanism will maintain its relevance. If at any point the mechanism of radio and extremely selective retail CD sales loses its relevance, the record industry is left holding rights to many, many acts that were planned to fail. Rather than holding rights on artists that can continue to keep a relevance in the new mediums and the modes of sales, the labels end up heavily overinvested in acts that were never meant to have a future. In effect, they have spent all their money on immediate promotional needs and nothing for artist development. The artist is turned into an impoverished formula with no particular ability to adapt to changing conditions. This stops being a good thing when you have to rely on the artist's own talent to drive additional sales. As an aside, to some extent, you can't expect too much from the labels. It tells you something when the official RIAA site dedicated to honoring the very artists that have earned the RIAA most of the money, that they actually get names wrong. They have Kim Carnes spelled with a K for her last name, the Rembrandts without the D, etc., etc., etc. The Rolling Stones' Black and Blue is missing a release date. Undercover is missing a release date. By Rush, Fly By Night release date is given as 1982, and it's actually 1975. But to top it off, Rush's Permanent Waves is listed as Permanent Wave. This is the album containing the immortal spirit of radio and a band with 13 platinum albums. You'd think they'd get the name right. Of course, the Rolling Stones have 25 platinum albums, and the RIAA cannot be bothered to look up a single, simple release date on the page supposedly honoring them, a task that would take about 10 seconds. Steely Dan's Gaucho from 1980 is also lacking a release date, which would probably really annoy Fagan and Becker. Likewise, Barbra Streisand's Songbird and Wet from another artist who in this case has given the music industry 27 platinum albums from 1965 to now. However, this is just whining. The RIAA invites such mockery by their current attitudes and disregard for the artists that they purportedly represent. What is more interesting is investigating trends in what they're doing as well as the merits of the actual artists. And here, too, there are striking discoveries. At the very top is of the page, and I read this at the start of the article, is the top 10 list of careers of commercial importance. Yet number 3 is Hollywood movie soundtracks, which actually outweighs Elvis, and number 5 is Broadway shows. So what's going on here? One word: convergence. There are good reasons for Hollywood soundtracks to get so much attention from the music industry. The labels can try to ride on the promotional budgets of the motion picture industry. There's, again, no need for artist career development. The whole thing can be written off as a work for hire quite plausibly. All in all, it makes sense. What is startling is the sheer scope of this activity. It's amazing just how heavily Hollywood treads in this area, and the consequences to musicians attempting to maintain careers in the mainstream music industry against the odds are very ominous. Hollywood is bigger than Elvis. No working artist can hope to compete for shelf space with this manifestation of convergence. Of the top 5 artists' careers ever, not only does Hollywood outweigh every other artist, but Zeppelin and the Beatles, every single actual band in the top 5 is dead. Hollywood has never been more alive in the music industry. Even with a cursory check of only soundtracks getting more or less... Even with a cursory check of only soundtracks getting no more or less than one platinum album between 1987 and 1994. This amounted to 26 soundtracks going platinum. But that's nothing to what happened to happened then. Between 1995 and 2000, it adds up to 47 soundtracks going platinum. There's not a year with less than 7 movie soundtracks selling a million records. In 1998 alone, 10 movie soundtracks went platinum. When you consider this in the light of the consolidation of rack jobbers and the rise to greater power in the industry, it tells a very ominous story. Even musicians who are being backed by their labels may lose out to the greater market pressure exerted by the MPAA, movie studios, and their desire for soundtrack revenue. The average number of soundtracks going platinum between 1986 and 1989 was 2.5, with much greater store catalog breadth. The average number of soundtracks going platinum between 1997 and 2000 was 8, with store catalog breadth much narrower and harder to compete for. This is convergence writ large and virtually impossible to fight. However, this must be understood in context. Although through these figures, we are looking at a severe narrowing and weeding out of the traditional music retail channel. Between the acquisitions of Clear Channel Communications on the radio and the ascendance of the rack jobbers, the sharply increasing pressure of Hollywood for a share of the dwindling store space, even the profound narrowing of Top 40 radio over the past 20 years, meaning the death of AOR and R&B stations, we are not only looking at an impossible tightening and restricting within the retail music channel, we are also looking at a narrowing of the retail music channel. If you define the music business as strictly what happens within retail music channel, the progression of these events has been entirely logical and sensible. However, if you define the music business as part of a larger commerce environment, or indeed a social environment, another story is told. In effect, through these developments, the RIAA is pricing itself out of the entertainment market, much as Clear Channel has led to decreased radio listenership by throttling that channel. The natural result? Napster. Napster is effectively dead, but the concept it represents couldn't be more different from the state of the retail music channel of today. The easy thing is to focus entirely on the free nature of the service as it existed. You copied patterns of bits, you got a crude, sometimes skipping facsimile of the music you wanted to hear without paying anything for it. The reality of this was so obvious that it conceals the other, more important aspects of the situation, which should be of more concern to the RIAA. Napster, as it existed, was the ultimate internet music store. And it is crucial to understand that the change in the meaning behind those three simple words, traditional music store, offered a selection of music for sale. Modern music retail is the result of a bitter fight to be included in a much narrower selection from top 40 to rack jobbers. Every step of the way, the trend has been to reduce inventory levels, to stock fewer selections, and to make it up on the volume. This impoverishes choice, but choice does not necessarily make money for the RIAA. Sales do. Compared to that, only part of Napster's appeal was current hits for free. The rest of Napster's appeal wasn't offering something no retail store could ever offer. Very nearly the history of recorded music, searchable and downloadable. This is only a slight exaggeration. Compared to modern retail outlets, Napster's peak was almost like having the history of recorded music at your fingertips. There was much overlap, but if only one person with a particular obscure item was logged on, you had it. The effect was of a store inventory of hundreds and thousands of times greater than any physical store. That was compelling, but this produced a peer-to-peer craze that now refuses to die. It says more about the Napster users than the simple fact that they like downloading inferior dubs of music for free. In early years, Napster may have garnered much less attention. People could have been disgusted at the many poor or incomplete files. People could have ignored the whole thing, knowing that they could buy the real CDs at a real store. But in the modern world, the consumer just cannot do that. The pressures of the music business have led to a wild constriction of consumer choice in the mainstream retail outlets, on mainstream radio, in every respect. The degree of control is so extreme that it's no longer possible to buy stuff unless it's mainstream, and record label execs forthwith proceed to study the market and try their level best to produce composite synthetic musicians and bands that can appeal to the largest or most profitable sections of the market. The trouble there is an error of market research. Only those completely uninformed of market research and advertising are prone to believe that there is an average consumer to be targeted by marketing, The reality of the situation is that the differentiation is king. The only purpose to consolidation is to make things practical. Even though car buyers might want 10,000 different colors, it's impractical to offer more than a few because you have to maintain inventories. Even though music consumers, who left uncontrolled, as in the electronic genres, break apart into a wild profusion of incomprehensible subgenres, it is impractical to stock 30,000 different sorts of music in a physical, real retail store. But, as illustrated by what happened in the electronic genre, the internet is not a physical store. Given the capacity to copy music at no significant cost from any of a million different storage places, the natural tendency for any consumer is to begin the process of differentiation. Once that starts, it doesn't stop. The person cultivates their own tastes and pursues additional differentiations amongst what is available to them. Particularly with the current climate of commercial music and the increasing narrowness of the traditional retail channel, vast numbers of musicians have been forced onto the internet. Some are good, some are not. Some were enjoying successes in the 60s and 70s. Some weren't even born then. But they can all participate in a situation where they can distribute their music, good or bad, at little or no cost to them. When music is just bits, you don't have to stay up all night dubbing cassettes. You don't have to buy 1,000 vinyl pressings just to get your work out there. You can rush it out. You can take risks because your capital investments are far smaller. You can get your product onto an impossibly huge shelf in an impossibly huge store. It may not pay you directly, but neither did the traditional industry most of the time. It certainly does not guarantee you attention or publicity, but again, the traditional music industry has never been very rewarding to people who didn't promote themselves. In that context, it can be said with great confidence that if the record industry attempts to reproduce the situation of modern retail sales online, doing nothing more than charging for digital copies of the very small number of artists currently occupying the shelves of retail outlets, they are doomed for two specific reasons. First, this course of action offers extremely poor differentiation compared with either illegal peer-to-peer trading or the often sketchier offerings of poorly resourced internet musicians releasing their works for free intentionally. Two, the record industry's increasing reliance on manufactured taste as defined by a channel whose future is in question leads it to what could be considered profit-taking, trying desperately to cash in by abandoning all artist career development and relying entirely on transient, malfeatured, manufactured artists with no serious potential for long-term sales. This is a very dangerous aspect. The music industry is, in essence, relying on a radio market that Clear Channels is driving people away from, relying on convergence with Hollywood for volume sales and getting rid of the bulk of established artists that could soften a transition to new forms of media and music distribution. In doing this, the music industry itself is producing the conditions for an explosive transition to other forms of music distribution more capable of differentiation. This is evidenced in Napster's proliferation, but it's very important to understand that cost consciousness is not the only issue, as it sometimes seemed with the Napster story. For the music industry, there can be several possible avenues for action. On the one hand, the industry can try and reverse its course and focus on artist development. This would cost money and would lead to the destruction of any single label that tries this course, as other labels outcompete the one that's trying to plan for the future. The industry can also try to address the threat of the internet differentiation differently, or directly. For instance, trying to gain a position as a toll booth over any and all internet music, including that of independents, or trying to threaten ISPs and OMDs into abandoning attempts to host unsigned musicians. These are, if anything, even more dangerous. They risk both complete alienation of the music industry's existing customers and the failure of the attempts to assert this control. There's no compelling case that the RIAA should be given the authority to silence artists who are not signed with RIAA contracts. The self-interest of it is the only possible reason for it, and it's very questionable that such an approach would be allowed to succeed. It would be seen as an infringement on civil liberties. For everybody else, the time to look to the music industry for a career is over. There is absolutely no future in it. What this means is, other opportunities will be opening up. It's possible that nobody understands what these will be yet. Napster is far from a blueprint for the future. Doing business on the internet, at least in terms of promotion and free goods, is a given. Make sure that an option remains open. People like free things, but many are also quite willing to spend money. The question is whether it will work to ask them to spend money on bits, intangible data that can be lost with a hard drive crash. It's very unlikely that pay per listen will ever meet with success. the value proposition is far too weak. Since CDs are extraordinarily ubiquitous, and future players can easily continue to play CDs even while adding other more restrictive formats, CDs will likely continue to have value as tangible, that people will be willing to buy to express their support for an artist. If non-commercial copying is permitted, this further strengthens the CD's position, as it can be used as a high-fidelity source for any number of digital music encoding formats. The problem will continue to be finding publicity despite lack of traditional media channels, except to be entirely locked out. This is where the lessons of the continued career sales take on heightened importance. Producing authentic, high-quality material is so overwhelmingly important that it's more valuable than doing any promotion. There's a lot of evidence in recent years that online internet OMDs... Let me try that again. There's a lot of evidence in recent years of online internet OMDs to suggest that any time spent promoting in traditional music industry is always wasted time. The whole context is different. When listeners have infinite variety and choice, the only sensible priority is to place full emphasis on the music and allow people to discover that at their own pace. This flies in the face of conventional retail and top 40 and Billboard magazine wisdom, but it works on the internet. It works to build careers over the long term and to cheaply and easily bring them up to roughly the amount of popularity the artist can ever achieve. You cannot become overexposed in this way because the popularity remains entirely audience-driven and all promotion rests with the fans themselves. It will indeed be interesting to see these two sides clash in the arena of popular taste. All right, well, DJ Toast is here. He's starting to get set up. So I think what we're going to do at this point is call it a close. You're listening to WRPI Troy. You've been listening to Little Brother. My name's Chuck Ritter. I'll be back in 3 weeks.